tiny figure in the niche that had been dug out of the limestone wall of her dwelling at the ninth cave, but she did have the scar. Ayla touched the small mark, then reached for the scar on her arm. Talut had cut that mark, and with the bloody knife had notched an ivory plaque that he wore suspended from a fantastic necklace of amber and cave lion canine teeth and claws to show that she was accepted into the lion camp, adopted by the Mamutoi. She had never asked. She had always been chosen, and for each acceptance she bore a mark, a scar that she would carry always. It was the sacrifice she'd had to make. Now she was being chosen again. She could still decline, but if she didn't refuse now, she was committed for life. It crossed her mind that the scars would always remind her that there were consequences to being chosen, responsibilities that came with acceptance. She looked into the eyes of the woman.
"I accept. I will be Zelandani,"
Ayla said, trying to sound firm and positive. Then she closed her eyes and felt someone come up behind the stool on which she was seated. Hands, gentle but firm, pulled her back to rest on the soft body of a woman for support, then held her head and turned it so that her right forehead was presented. She felt a wash of liquid from something soft and wet wiped across her forehead, recognized the odor of iris root, a solution she had often used to clean wounds, and felt an anxious tension arise within her.
"Oh, ow!"
she cried out involuntarily as she felt the quick cut of a sharp blade, then fought to control such outbursts at a second cut, and then a third. The solution was applied again, then the cuts were dried, and another substance was rubbed in. This time the pain stung like a burn, but not for long. Something in the stinging salve had numbed the pain.
"You can open your eyes, Ayla. It's over," the large woman said. Ayla opened her eyes to see a rather dim, unfamiliar image. It took her a moment to realize what she was seeing. Someone was holding up a reflector and a lighted lamp, so she could see herself in the oiled piece of sand-smoothed, black-stained wood. She seldom used a reflector, didn't even have one in her dwelling, and was always surprised to see her own face. Then her eyes were drawn to the marks on her forehead. Just in front of her right temple was a short horizontal line with two vertical lines extending up from each end of about the same length, like a square with no top line or an open box. The three lines were black, with a little blood still oozing out around the edges. They looked so conspicuous, they seemed to diminish everything else. Ayla wasn't at all sure that she liked having her face marred like that, but there was nothing she could do about it now. It was done. She would carry those black marks on her face for the rest of her life. She started to reach up to feel it, but the first stopped her. "It's best if you don't touch it just yet," she said. "It has almost stopped bleeding, but it's still fresh."
Ayla looked around at the rest of the Zelandania. They all had various marks on their foreheads, some more intricate than others, mostly square, but with other shapes as well, many filled in with color. The markings of the first were the most elaborate of all. She knew they designated rank, position, affiliation of the Zelandania. She noticed, however, that the black lines faded to blue tattoos after they healed. She was glad when they took the reflector away. She didn't like looking at herself. It made her uncomfortable to think that the strange, dim image of the face she saw belonged to her. She preferred to see herself reflected in the expressions of others, the happiness of her daughter when she saw her mother, the pleasure of seeing herself in the aspect and demeanor of people she cared about, like Marthona and Proliva, Joharan and Dalinar, and the look of love in Jondalar's eyes when he saw, not anymore. The last time he saw her, he was horrified. His look showed shock and dismay, not love. Ayla closed her eyes to shut off impending tears and tried to control her feelings of loss, disappointment, and pain. When she opened them and looked up, all the Zelandania were standing in front of her, including the two new ones, a woman and a man, who had been on guard outside, and all of them had warm smiles of anticipation and welcome. The one who was first spoke.
"You have traveled far, have belonged to many people, but your feet have always led you along the path the great Earth Mother chose for you. It was your fate to lose your people at an early age, and then be taken in by a healer and a man who traveled the spirit world of those people you call the clan. When you were adopted by the Mammut of the Mammutoi to the Mammoth Hearth that honors the Mother, your way was guided by she who gave birth to all. Your destiny has always been to serve her. Ayla of the Ninth Cave of the Zelandanyi, mated to Jandalar of the Ninth Cave, son of Marthona, former leader of the Ninth Cave of the Zelandanyi, mother of John Ayla, blessed of Dani of the Ninth Cave of the Zelandanyi, who was born to the hearth of Jandalar, Ayla of the Mammutoi, member of the lion camp of the mammoth-hunting people to the east, daughter of the mammoth hearth, the Zelandania of the Mammutoi, Ayla, chosen by the spirit of the cave lion and protected by the cave bear of the clan. Your names and ties are many. Now they are no longer needed. Your new name means all of them and more. Your name is one with all of her creation. Your name is Zelandani. Your name is one with all of her creation. Welcome, Zelandani, the assembled group said in unison. Come join with us in the mother's song, Zelandani of the Ninth Cave, said the one who was first, and the group began entirely in unison. Out of the darkness, the chaos of time, the whirlwind gave birth to the mother sublime. When they reached the verse that had always been the last, only the one who was first continued in her beautiful, rich voice. The mother was pleased with the pair she created. She taught them to love and to care when they mated. She made them desire to join with each other. The gift of their pleasures came from the mother. Before she was through, her children loved too. The whole group sang the last line. Then they all looked expectantly at Ayla. It took her a moment to comprehend. Then, in a strong voice, with an exotic accent, Ayla didn't sing, but spoke alone.
Her last gift, the knowledge that man has his part. His need must be spent before new life can start. It honors the mother when the couple is paired, because woman conceives when pleasures are shared. Earth's children were blessed. The mother could rest.
The group finished the final line and stood silently for a while. Then they broke up and relaxed. A large container of tea was brought out, and each one took out individual cups from pouches and pockets. The question now is, how do we tell the rest of the Zelandanyi about the last gift? Said the one who was first, as she casually sat on her stool. The question brought an uproar.
Tell them? We can't tell them.
It would be too much for them. Think how much it would upset everything.
The first waited until the disturbance settled down. Then she looked at the assembled Zelandania with a fierce glance. Do you think Dani made this known so you could withhold it from her children? Do you think Ayla suffered those agonies, or that she was required to sacrifice her baby just so the Zelandania would have something to argue about? The Zelandania are those who serve the mother. It is not for us to say whether or not her children may know. It is our task to decide how to tell them. There was contrite silence. Then the Zelandani of the 14th said,
It will take time to plan an appropriate ceremony. Perhaps we should wait until next year. This season is almost over. Everyone will be going back soon.
Yes, the Zelandani of the Third quickly agreed. Perhaps the best way would be to let each Zelandani tell his own cave in his own way, after he's had some time to think about it.
The ceremony will be held 3 days from now, and Ayla will tell them, the first announced unequivocally. It was Ayla who was given the gift. It is her place, her duty, to tell the rest. She was called this season and sent to this summer meeting for that reason. The first glared at her fellow Danyers, then her expression softened and her tone became cajoling. Wouldn't it be better to get it over with now? With the season so close to the end, there won't be time for too many difficulties to arise before we leave, and you can be sure there will be difficulties. But this way, we will have all winter to get our own caves used to the idea. By next season, there shouldn't be any reason for problems. The first wished she really believed that. Unlike the rest of the Zelandania, the first had thought about a man's contribution to creating new life for many years, even before her first conversation with Ayla. The fact that Ayla had come to her own similar conclusions was one of the reasons the woman had wanted her to become Zelandani. Her observations were too perceptive, and she wasn't restricted by Zelandani beliefs fed to her with mother's milk. That was why Zelandani had decided as soon as she heard Ayla tell about her experience in the cave that the idea must be made known immediately when everyone was still together. And while the Zelandania were still bewildered by it, she would have set the ceremony for the next day if she had thought it was possible to arrange it. As she often did under the guise of resting or meditating and seeming to ignore her surroundings, the woman waited and watched for a while as the Zelandania began to make plans. At first, they were tentative. She heard the 11th say,
"Maybe a good approach might be to try to duplicate Ayla's own experience."
"We don't have to show her entire experience, just the essence of it," said the 23rd.
"If we had a cave large enough to hold everyone, it would help," the Zelandani of the second cave said.
"We'll have to let the darkness of night act as the walls of a cave," the fifth said. "If we have just one fire in the middle, it will help to concentrate everyone's attention."
Good, the first thought, listening to the Danyers speaking among themselves. They are starting to think of how to plan the ceremony, rather than thinking of objections to it.
"We should have drums for the mother's song."
"And singing."
"The ninth doesn't sing."
"Her voice is so distinctive it doesn't matter."
"We can have singing in the background, without words, just the sound."
"If we slow the cadence of the drums, the mother's song will have a greater impact, especially at the end, when she speaks the last verse."
Ayla seemed at a loss with all the attention, as more suggestions were made for her part. But after a while, even she seemed to be getting involved with the arrangements.
"The visitors from the Mamutoi, the two young men, Danuk and Druez, they know how to play drums so that they actually sound like a voice speaking. It's uncanny, but very mysterious. I think they could make the drums speak the final verse if they brought their drums, or we can find something similar."
"I would like to hear it first," said the 14th.
"Of course," Ayla said.
More than she realized, Ayla was incredibly wise in the ways of people, and much more sophisticated and knowledgeable than she knew. The tactics of the Zelandani who was first in pushing the Zelandania into creating the ceremony were not lost on Ayla. On a sometimes subliminal and sometimes fully aware level, she had watched the first mold the rest to her will. The woman was quick to press her advantage, knew when to bluster, when to threaten, when to cajole, wheedle, criticize, praise, and the Zelandania were not easily led. As a group, they were clever, shrewd, often cynical, and on the whole more intelligent than most. Ayla remembered Jandalar asking Zelandani once what made a Zelandani first. Even then she knew just how much to say, just how much to hold back. Zelandani relaxed. They were into it now. It would gain momentum of its own accord. Her problem most of the time was to keep them from getting too carried away. This time she was going to let them take on just as much as they wanted. The more spectacular, the better. If I let them plan it big enough and elaborate enough, they won't have time to think about anything else until after the ceremony. When the general outline for the ceremony had begun to take shape, and most of the Zelandania were developing a decided interest in the event, Zelandani, who was first, hurled another surprise at them. Getting up to get more tea, she made an ostensibly offhand comment. "I imagine we'll also have to make plans for a camp meeting a day or so after the ceremony to answer questions that are bound to come up. We might as well get them out of the way all at once. That's when we can announce the name for the relationship between a man and his children and tell them that the men will name the boys from now on," she said. The consternation of the Zelandania was immediate. Most hadn't had time to think about what changes the new knowledge was going to make.
"But a mother has always named her own children," one of them said.
Zelandani caught a few sharp looks. That's what she had been afraid of. Some of them were going to start thinking. As a group, it was not wise to underestimate the Zelandania. "How are the men going to realize that they are an essential if we don't let them take some part?" the first asked. "It doesn't really change anything. Coupling will still be a pleasure. Men are not going to start giving birth, and a man will still need to provide for the woman he has taken to his hearth and her children, especially while she is confined close to home and with small children. Naming a male child is a small thing. Women will still name the females," the woman cajoled.
"In the clan, the Mogurs named all the children," Ayla mentioned.
Everyone stopped and looked at her.
"I was very pleased to be able to name my daughter. I was nervous about it, but it was very exciting, and it made me feel very important."
"I think the men would feel the same way," the first said, grateful for Ayla's unplanned support. There were nods and grunts of approval. No one brought up any further objections, at least for the moment.
"What about the name of the relationship? Have you a name for it already?"
the Zelandani from the 29th cave asked, with a hint of suspicion. "I thought I would meditate and see if I could think of something appropriate for children to call the men who shared in giving them life, to distinguish them from other men. Perhaps we should all think about it," the one who was first said. The first had felt that she had to push them now, while the Zelandania were still overwhelmed and at a disadvantage relative to herself, before they began to think about the possible consequences and come up with some real objections that she couldn't confound with bluster. She had no doubt that this new gift of the knowledge of life would have more profound repercussions than even she could imagine. It would change everything, and she wasn't entirely sure that she liked some of the very real possibilities that might develop. The Zelandani who was first was a keenly observant, intelligent woman. She had never had a child of her own, but in her case that was an advantage. She never had the distractions that children invariably entailed. But she had been a midwife at more births than she cared to count, and had helped many women through miscarriages. As a result, the first had more knowledge of the developmental stages of unborn fetuses than any mother. The Danyers were also instrumental in helping some women end their pregnancies before full term. The most precarious time in the lives of infants was the first 2 years. Many children died then, even with the help of mates, elder parents, or other extended family members. Most mothers could not nurse and care for too many young children at one time, if any were to survive. Although nursing a baby, in itself, seemed to be a deterrent to starting another, it was sometimes necessary to terminate an unanticipated pregnancy if those who were already born were to live past infancy, or if a woman was seriously ill, or had children who were nearly grown and was too old, or had had one or more harrowing deliveries in the past that had brought her close to death, and another pregnancy could deprive existing children of their mother. The mortality rate of children would have been appreciably higher if they did not practice such selective controls as were available to them. There might be other reasons as well for a woman to end her pregnancy. And while the cause of pregnancy was not innately apparent, women did know that they were pregnant fairly soon. At some earlier time, a woman or women had discovered how to know that a child was growing inside of her before it was obvious. Perhaps she noticed that it had been some time since she had bled, and she had learned that that could be a sign. Or if she had been pregnant before, she might recognize certain symptoms. The knowledge had been passed down until all women learned it as part of their initiation into adulthood. In the beginning, when a woman realized she was carrying a child, she might look back and try to think about what had caused it. Was it a certain food she ate, a special pool she had bathed in, a specific man she'd had relations with, a particular river she had crossed, a unique tree in whose shade she had slept? If a woman wanted to have a baby, she might try repeating some or all of those activities, perhaps making it into a ritual. But she would learn that she could do any of those things any number of times and still not necessarily become pregnant. She then might wonder if it was a combination of actions, or the order in which they were done, or the time of day, or the cycle, or season, or year. Maybe just a strong desire to have a baby, or the concerted wishes of several people. Or perhaps it was unknown agents, emanations from rocks, or spirits from another world, or the Great Mother, the First Mother. If she lived in a society that had developed a set of explanations that seemed reasonable, or even unreasonable, but that seemed to answer questions that were not accessible to her own observations, it would be easy to accept them if everyone else did. But someone might be observant enough to begin to make connections and draw inferences that were close to the truth. Because of a unique set of circumstances, Ayla had come to such conclusions, though she'd had to overcome the strong urge to believe what others believed instead of her own observations and reasoning. Even before talking to Ayla, the one who was first had also begun to suspect the true cause of conception. Ayla's belief and explanation was the final piece of information she needed to persuade herself, and she had felt for some time that people, women in particular, should know how new life was started. Knowledge was power. If a woman knew what caused a baby to begin growing inside her, she could gain control over her own life. Instead of simply finding herself pregnant, whether she wanted a baby or not, whether the timing was right for her to have one, whether she was well enough or had enough children already, she had a choice. If it was relations with a man that somehow caused the pregnancy, not something external and out of her hands, she could decide not to have a baby simply by choosing not to share pleasures with a man. Of course, it wouldn't necessarily be easy for a woman to make that choice, and Zelandani wasn't at all sure how the men would react. Though there would likely be unknown repercussions, There was another reason that she wanted her people to know that children were the result of the union of women and men. The strongest reason of all, because it was true. And men needed to know it, too. Men had been considered incidental to the process of procreation for too long. It was only right that men should know that they were essential to the creation of life. And Zelandani believed the people were ready for it, more than ready. Ayla had already told Jandalar what she believed, and he was nearly convinced. More, he wanted to believe. This was the right time. If Zelandani herself had guessed it, and if Ayla could work it out, so could others. The first hoped that the consequences of telling everyone would not be too devastating, but if the Zelandania didn't tell them now, it was bound to come from someone else before long. As soon as she heard Ayla recite the new final verse to the mother's song, Zelandani knew the truth had to be revealed now. But to be accepted, it could not be divulged casually or piecemeal. It needed dramatic impact. The one who was first was clever enough to understand that most of what happened to acolytes in the course of being called to serve the mother were the products of their own minds. A few of the older Zelandania had become entirely cynical about the whole process, but there were always inexplicable events that were caused by unknown or unseen forces. It was those events that revealed a true calling. And when Ayla talked about her experience in the cave, the first had never heard a truer calling, in particular that final verse of the mother's song. Though Ayla's instinct for language and ability to memorize was phenomenal, and she had become a skillful and compelling teller of stories and speaker of legends, she had never before displayed an ability to create verse, and she had said it filled her head, that she heard it complete. If she could explain it to the people with the same conviction, she would be very persuasive. When it seemed to the first that everything was in motion and could not be stopped, she finally announced, "It's getting late. This has been a long meeting. I think we should go now and meet again tomorrow morning."
"I promised John Ayla I would go riding with her today," Ayla was explaining, "but the meeting took so long."
No wonder, Proliva thought to herself, eyeing the black marks on Ayla's forehead, but she refrained from saying anything.
"Jandalar heard her talking to me about going out on the horses with you, wondering where you were and what was taking so long. Dalinar tried to explain to her that you were at a very important meeting, and no one knew how long you would be. Then Jandalar offered to take her out."
"I'm glad he did," Ayla said. "I hated to disappoint her. Have they been gone long?"
"Most of the afternoon. I imagine they will be back soon," Proliva said. "Dalinar did ask me to remind you that the Lansadanyi are expecting you this evening."
"That's right. He did ask when I was on my way to the meeting. I think I'll change clothes and rest for a while. It's hard to believe that just sitting around at the meeting can make you so tired. Will you send John Ayla in to get me when she gets here?"
"Of course I will," Proliva said. It was a lot more than just a meeting, I'm sure, she thought.
"Would you like something to eat? Maybe a little tea?" "Yes, I think I would, Proliva. But I'd like to clean up a little first. I'd love to go for a swim, but I guess I should wait until later. I think I'll go check on Winnie first."
They took her with them. Jandalar said she'd want to go with the other horses, and the run wouldn't hurt her.
"He's right. Winnie probably missed her children, too."
Proliva watched Ayla walk toward the sleeping lodge. "She does look tired," the woman thought. "Not surprising. Look what she's been through. Having a miscarriage, and now becoming our newest Zelandani, and getting her call, whatever that really means." The woman had seen the effects of getting too close to the spirit world. Everyone had, Any time someone was seriously hurt, for example, or even more frightening, had an inexplicable critical illness, she knew they were near the next world. The idea that a person would purposely put themselves in contact with that world so that they could serve the mother was almost beyond her comprehension. Proliva felt a slight shudder. She was grateful that she would never have to go through such a harrowing experience. While she knew that someday everyone would have to move on to that fearful place, she had no desire whatever to join the ranks of the Zelandania. She and Jandalar are having problems, too, Proliva thought. He's been avoiding her. I've watched him go the other way as soon as he sees her. I'm sure I know what his problem is. He's feeling ashamed. She caught him with Morona, and now he doesn't want to face her. This is not a good time for him to be avoiding Ayla. She needs everyone's help now, especially his. If he didn't want Ayla to know about Morona, he shouldn't have started up with her again, even if she was encouraging him every way she could. He knew how Ayla would feel about her. He could have found some other woman if he had to have one. It's not like he still couldn't have his pick of just about any woman in the whole camp, and it would have served that Morona woman right. She's so obvious. You'd think even he would see it. As much as Proliva cared about him, there were times when her mate's younger brother exasperated her.
"Mother, Mother, are you finally back? Proliva said you were here. You said we would go for a ride today, and I was waiting and waiting,"
Janela said. The wolf, who bounded in after her, was just as excited, trying to get Ayla's attention. She gave the girl a big hug, then grabbed the head of the big carnivore and started to rub his face with hers, but her marks were feeling sore, so she just hugged him. He started to sniff her wound, but she pushed him away. He looked into his food dish instead, found a bone Proliva had left there earlier, and took it to his resting place.
"I'm sorry, Janela," Ayla said. "I didn't know the meeting with the Zelindania would take so long. I promise we'll do it another day, but it may not be tomorrow."
"It's all right, Mother. The Zelindania do take a long time. They spent a whole day teaching us songs and dances and stuff, showing us where to stand and what steps to make. I did get to go riding anyway. Jandi took me.
Proliva told me. I'm glad he did. I know how much you wanted to go," Ayla said.
"Does that hurt, Mother?"
Janela asked, pointing to Ayla's forehead. Ayla was slightly taken aback that her daughter had noticed.
"No, not now. It did a little at first, but not bad. That mark has a special meaning."
"I know what it means," the girl said. "It means you're Zelandani now."
"That's right, Janela."
"Jandi told me you won't have to be gone so much after you get a Zelandani mark. Is that true, Mother?"
Ayla hadn't realized how much her daughter had missed her, and she felt a rush of gratitude that Jandalar had been there to take care of her and explain things to her. She reached out to hug the child.
"Yes, it's true. I will still have to be gone sometimes, but not as much."
Maybe Jandalar missed her, too. But why did he have to turn to Morona? He said he loved her, even after she found them like that. But if he did, why was he staying away from her now?
"Why are you crying, Mother?" the girl said. "Are you sure that mark doesn't hurt? It looks sore."
"I'm just so glad to see you, Janela."
She let go of the child, but smiled at her through wet eyes.
"I almost forgot to tell you. We are going to visit the Lanzadanyi camp and have a meal with them tonight."
"With Dalinar and Bokovan?"
"That's right, and Echazar and Joplea and Jerica and everybody."
"Is Jandi coming?"
"I don't know, but I don't think so. He had to go someplace else."
Suddenly, Ayla turned aside, and seeing Janela's clothing basket, started going through it. She didn't want her daughter to see her in tears again.
"It will get cold after it gets dark. Would you like to change into something warmer?"
"Can I wear the new tunic that Folara made for me?"
"That would be a good idea, Janela."
Chapter 35. At first glance, in the distance, Ayla thought it was Jandalar carrying something, coming towards her along the well-worn main path between the camps of several friendly caves. She felt her stomach tightening to a knot. The height, the shape of the body, the walk were so familiar. But as the man approached, she saw it was Dalinar carrying Bokovan. As soon as they neared, Dalinar saw the obvious black marks on her forehead. Ayla noted Dalinar's look of surprise when he first saw her, then his effort to avoid looking at her forehead, and remembered her marks. She didn't see them and tended to forget them. "Is that why Jandalar is behaving so strangely?" Dalinar wondered. When he had invited Jandalar to join the Lanzadanyi for a meal along with Ayla and Janela, Dalinar had been surprised by Jandalar's hesitation and then refusal. He claimed he had already promised to be some other place, but he looked upset and embarrassed. It was as though he was looking for excuses not to join them this evening. He recalled his own reasons for leaving a woman he loved, but I didn't think Jandalar was bothered by her becoming Zelandani, the older man thought. He always seemed to be proud of her skill as a healer and content to be working the flint and training his apprentices.
"Would you let me carry you for a while, Bokovan, and give Dalinar a rest?"
Ayla said, holding out her arms to him and smiling. The youngster hesitated, then held out his arms to her. She remembered how much he weighed when she picked him up. Ayla, carrying Bokovan, walked alongside Dalinar, who was holding John Ayla's hand as they headed towards his camp. Wolf followed along behind. The animal seemed to be perfectly comfortable wandering through the large camp of people now, and none of the people appeared particularly concerned about him. Ayla had noticed, however, that the Zelandanyi took a special delight in the reactions of visitors or strangers who were not accustomed to seeing a wolf mingle so freely with people. When they arrived, Joplea and Jerrica came to greet her, and Ayla noticed their look of surprise and not quite successful attempt to ignore her new forehead marks. Although there was still an air of sadness about the beautiful dark-haired young woman who Jandalar called cousin, Ayla noticed a smile of warm love light up her vivid green eyes as she took her son. Joplea seemed more relaxed, more accepting of her life, and genuinely pleased to see Ayla. Jerrica also greeted her warmly.
"Let me take Bokovan," she said, taking the child from his mother's arms. "I have some food ready for him. You and Ayla can visit."
Ayla spoke directly to the boy.
"I am glad I met you, Bokovan. Will you come to visit me? I'm from the ninth cave. Do you know where it is?"
He stared at her for a while, then with great seriousness he said,
"Yes."
Ayla could not help but notice both the similarities and the differences between Jerrica, Joplea, and Bokovan before his grandmother took him away. The older woman was short and sturdy, her movements quick and energetic. Her hair, once as dark as the night sky, was now showing sunset streaks of gray. Her face, round and flat with high cheekbones, was more wrinkled, but her black slanted eyes still sparkled with charm and wit. Ayla remembered Hochiman, the man who had been mated to Jerrica's mother. He had been the traveler, and his mate had chosen to go along with him. Jerrica was born along the way. Ayla recalled Dalinar telling the Sarmunai visitor about Hochiman's long journey from the endless seas of the east all the way to the great waters of the west with pride. It occurred to her that even though the truth was exceptional in itself, it was the kind of story that would be told and retold, probably growing with each telling, until it became a legend or myth with little resemblance to the original story. Dalinar had met Jerrica some time after he found his flint mine, and had been at first intrigued and then captivated by the exotic woman. Several people had already gathered around Dalinar and his flint mine, beginning the nucleus of the cave that would later be called the Lanzadanyi, when Hochiman and Jerrica arrived at his camp. They looked so unusual, it was obvious they had come from a great distance. Dalinar had never seen anyone like Jerrica. She was tiny in comparison with most women, but intelligent and strong-minded, and he was captivated by the exotic young woman. It had taken someone that unusual to finally vanquish his great love for Marthona. Joplea was born to Dalinar's hearth. Aayla now knew that what she had long believed was true. Joplea was as much Dalinar's child as she was Jerrica's. But Jondalar had not gone to live with the Lanzadanyi until he and Joplea were both adolescents. They had not been raised together as sister and brother, and Joplea had fallen hopelessly in love with Jondalar, even though he was a close cousin, an unmateable man. Joplea is as much his sister as Falara, Aayla thought, trying to sort out what the new relationships would mean. Jondalar and Falara are both children of Marthona, and Jondalar and Joplea are both Dalinar's children. You can see him in both of them. Jondalar was a younger replica of Dalinar, while Joplea showed more of her mother's influence. But she was tall like Dalinar, and a more subtle contribution showed in other ways. Her hair was dark, but had light highlights. It was not the pure glossy sheen her mother's had been. Her face had the contours of Dalinar's people, with her mother's high cheekbones, but her most stunning feature were her eyes. Neither black like her mother's, nor vivid blue like Dalinar's and Jondalar's, Joplea's eyes were a vivid green with accents of hazel, with a shape and epicanthic fold like her mother, but less pronounced. Jerrica was obviously a foreigner, but in many ways Joplea seemed more exotic than her mother because of her similarities. Joplea had decided to mate with Echazar because she knew she could never have the man she loved. She chose him, she once told Aayla, because she knew she'd never find a man who would love her more, and she was right. Echazar was one of mixed spirits. His mother had been clan, and many people thought he was as ugly as Joplea was beautiful, but not Aayla. She was sure Echazar looked the way her son would when he grew up. Bokovan exhibited all of the components of his unusual background, the physical strength of the clan from Echazar, along with the height of his mother and Dalinar, were already obvious. His eyes were only slightly slanted and dark, nearly as dark as Jerrica's, but not exactly black. Touches of a lighter shade or a reflective sparkle gave them a vivid quality she had never seen in such dark eyes. They were not only unusual, they were compelling. She sensed something special about Bokovan and wished the Lanzadanyi lived closer. She would love to watch him grow up. He was only a little younger than her son had been the last time she saw him, and he reminded her so much of Dirk. It almost hurt. Aayla wondered what kind of mind he would have. Would he have some aspect of the clan memories, along with the capacity to make art and speak with words? Like Dalinar's and Jerrica's people, she had often thought about her son in the same way.
Bokovan is a very special child, Joplea, Aayla said. When he's a little older, I wish you would consider sending him to the ninth cave for me to keep for a while.
Why? Joplea asked.
Partly because he may have some unique qualities that could lead to the Zalindania, and you might want to know about that, but mostly because I would love to get to know him better, Aayla said.
Joplea smiled, then paused.
Would you be willing to send John Ayla to the Lanzadani to stay with me for a while?
I never thought about it, Ayla said, but that might be a good idea. In a few years, if she'd be willing to go, why do you want her?
I'll never have a girl. I'll never have another child. It was too hard on me giving birth to Bokovan,
Joplaya said. Ayla remembered the difficulties she had giving birth to her son Dirk, the one born to the clan, and she had heard about Joplaya's problems.
Are you sure, Joplaya? One difficult birth doesn't mean they all will be.
Our Danyar says she doesn't think I should try. She's afraid I would die. I came very close with Bokovan. I'm taking the medicine that you gave the Zelandania, and Mother tries to make sure I take it. I do it to please her, but even if I didn't, I don't think it would matter. I don't think I can get pregnant again. In spite of Mother, I stopped taking the medicine for a while. I wanted another child. But Donnie chose not to bless me,
Joplaya said. Ayla didn't want to pry, but as a Zelandani, she felt she had to ask, especially now.
Do you honor the Mother frequently? It is important, if you want the Mother to bless you, that you honor her properly.
Joplaya smiled.
Echazar is a sweet and loving man. He may not be the one I wanted, Ayla.
She paused, and for a fleeting moment a look of desolation darkened her expression. Ayla matched it with one of her own for an entirely different reason.
But I was right when I said no one could love me more than Echazar, and I have truly come to care for him. In the beginning, he could hardly bring himself to touch me out of fear that he would somehow hurt me, and because, I think, he couldn't quite believe he had the right. We are beyond that now, although he still acts so grateful sometimes I have to tease him out of it. He's even learning to laugh at himself. I think Donnie is properly honored.
Ayla thought for a while. It was possible that the problem wasn't Joplaya's, but Echazar's. He was half-clan, and there could be a reason why a man who was clan, or even just part, might experience some problem having a child with one of the others. One child could have been just luck, though some would call him abomination, not luck. She wasn't sure how often someone of the clan actually coupled with one of the others, or how many of the offspring lived or were allowed to live. Everyone knew about those with mixed spirits, but she hadn't seen very many. She stopped to consider them. There was her son Dirk and Ura at the clan gathering, Rydag of the Mamutoi lion camp. Possibly Ataroa and others among the Sarmunai had clan mixed in. Echazar was half, and of course there was Bokovan. It was likely Brukaval's mother had been half, too, which accounted for his characteristic look. She was going to ask how well the mother was honored at ceremonies and festivals among the Lanzadani. They were still a small group, although there had been some talk, she knew, about where they would locate a second cave sometime in the future. It occurred to her that perhaps she ought to talk to their Zelandani first. After all, she was one of the Zelandania and ought to discuss such things with another Zelandani. Perhaps I should consult with the first. She may have some thoughts on the matter, Ayla thought. Echazar arrived at the camp then, and the subject changed. She was glad for the chance to stop trying to be Zelandani and just be a friend. He gave her a broad smile, which still startled her somewhat on a face so strongly clan. An expression that bared the teeth had a different meaning in the clan she grew up with.
"Ayla, how good to see you," Echazar said as they embraced.
He, too, had noticed the fresh mark on her forehead, and though he understood what it meant, he had been adopted by Dalinar's people, and it didn't affect him quite the same way. He knew she was an acolyte, and expected her to become a Zelandani someday. He might have commented on it, but he'd been exposed to more than his share of comment about the way he looked, and was reluctant to bring up any aspect of another person's appearance.
"And here's the wolf," he said,
feeling just a touch of apprehension when Wolf sniffed him. The Lanzadanyi were not as familiar with the animal, and though he did remember him, it took a while to get used to the idea of a wolf mingling freely with people.
"I heard he was here. That's how I knew you had arrived. I was afraid we wouldn't see you after making the trip all the way here. Some of us were even considering going to the ninth cave to see you before we left. Your Mamutoi kin and their Sarmunai friend are definitely planning to go, and some of the Lanzadanyi were thinking of going along," Echazar said.
Ayla thought he seemed much more confident and relaxed, and was sure Dalinar was right about how helpful it had been for Echazar to be accepted so easily by Danug and Druez, and what was his name? Aldenor. She was sure Jandalar had welcomed him too, along with their kin and several close friends. Jandalar would be very good about making Echazar feel welcome, but he hadn't said one single welcoming word to her. The only time she had seen him since she arrived was in the small woods, standing naked with Morona. Ayla had to look away to fight back the sudden tightness in her throat and sting of impending tears, feelings that seemed to come upon her at the most unexpected moments lately. She said she had something in her eye.
"Just because I've come to the summer meeting doesn't mean you can't come to visit the ninth cave," Ayla said after a moment. "It's not very far from here, and since you are so close, you might as well. I think Dalinar and Joplea would be interested in the way Jandalar has set up the training for his flint-napping apprentices. He has six of them now," Ayla said, sounding almost normal.
After all, she could hardly help talking about Jandalar to Dalinar and Joplea.
"And I'd love to see a little more of Bokovan, and of course all the rest of you."
"I think that little one has charmed Ayla completely," Dalinar said.
Everyone smiled benignly.
"He is going to be a big man," Echazar said, "and I want to teach him to be a good hunter."
Ayla grinned at him. For a moment she could imagine that Echazar was a man of the clan, proud of the son of his hearth.
"He may turn out to be more than just a big man, Echazar. I think he's a very special child."
"Where is Jandalar?" Echazar asked. "Wasn't he supposed to come and share a meal with us tonight?" "I saw him when he was taking Janela out with the horses after midday. He said he couldn't make it," Dalinar said, sounding disappointed.
"I was going to take Janela out, but the Zelandani meeting took longer than I expected," Ayla said.
Everyone glanced up at her forehead.
"Did he say why he couldn't come?" Echazar asked. "I don't know. Something about other plans and promises he made before Ayla came."
Ayla felt her stomach knot. "I can imagine what promises he made," she thought. It was nearly dark by the time Ayla insisted she had to go. Echazar walked back with her and Janela and Wolf, carrying a torch.
"You look happy, Echazar," Ayla said.
"I am happy, although I still find it hard to believe Joplea is my mate. Sometimes I wake up at night and just look at her in the firelight. She is so beautiful, and she's wonderful, kind and understanding. I feel so lucky I sometimes wonder how I could deserve her."
"She's lucky too, you know. I wish we lived closer."
"So you could see more of Bokovan," he said.
She saw his teeth gleaming with a smile.
"It's true. I would like to see more of Bokovan, and you and Joplea and everyone else," Ayla said.
"Have you considered coming back with us and staying over winter?" Echazar asked. "You know, Dalinar says you and Jandalar are always welcome." Ayla frowned, staring into the dark.
"Yes, of course,"
Jandalar, she thought.
I don't think Jandalar would want to leave his apprentices. He has made promises, and winter is the best time to work on perfecting techniques, she said.
Etchazar was silent for a few paces. I don't suppose you'd want to leave Jandalar for a season and visit by yourself, with Janela and your animals, of course, he said. As much as she loves Bokovan, I know Joplea would love to have that little girl around. She and Bokovan spent a lot of time at Lavila's camp and got to know her.
I don't know. I guess I never thought about it. I've been so busy training for the Zelandania, she said,
then glanced around, looking for her daughter, who was straggling behind. She has probably found something along the path to distract her, Ayla thought.
We would never object to having another Danya, Etchazar said.
Ayla smiled at him, then stopped.
Janela, why are you so far back?
I'm tired, Mother,
Janela whined.
Would you carry me?
Ayla stopped to pick her daughter up, using a hip for support. The little girl's arms felt good around her neck. She had missed Janela and hugged her little body close. They continued in silence for a while and began to hear raucous voices. Ahead, they could see the light of a campfire behind a fairly dense stand of brush. It wasn't a regular cave sight, Ayla gathered as they drew closer. Through the screen of brush, she noticed several men sitting around the fire. They were obviously gaming and drinking something from miniature water bags made from the nearly waterproof stomachs of small animals. She knew many of the men. Several were from the ninth cave, but there was a sprinkling of others from several different caves. Larimar was there, the man who was known for making the potent alcoholic brew from almost anything that would ferment. While they didn't have the refinement of the wine that Marthona made, the drinks he produced weren't bad. He did very little of anything else and had perfected what had become his craft, but he made it in quantity, and many people regularly drank too much, creating problems. His only other claim to fame had been a hearthful of unkempt children and a slovenly mate who indulged heavily in his product. Ayla and the rest of the cave took more care of the children than either Larimar or Tremita did. Now the oldest girl, Lanoga, was mated to Lanadar and had a child of her own, but the young couple had adopted all her younger siblings. Her older brother, Bolagan, also lived with them and helped to provide for the children. He had also helped to build their new dwelling, along with Jandalar and several others. Her mother, Tremita, and Larimar also lived with them occasionally when they chose to go to a place they called home, and both of them behaved as though it was theirs. Besides Larimar, Ayla noticed the distinctive forehead markings of a Zelandani on one man, but when he smiled, she saw the gap of his missing front teeth and frowned, realizing it was Madraman. Had he already been accepted into the Zelandania and tattooed? She didn't think so. She looked again and noticed that an edge of the tattoo was smeared. He must have painted it on, using the colors that some people use to temporarily decorate their faces for special occasions. But she had never seen anyone decorate with Zelandani marks before. Seeing him reminded her of the backpack she found in the cave and brought to the first. Though he invariably smiled and tried to engage her in conversation, she had always felt uneasy around Madraman. He disturbed her in a way that made her think of how a horse's fur looked when it was stroked opposite to the direction in which it grew. He rubbed her the wrong way. She saw many young men talking and laughing loudly, but there were other men of all ages. From what she knew of those she recognized, none of them contributed much. Some were not too bright or were easily led. One of them spent most of his time drinking Larimar's brew, barely stumbling home each night,
and often could be found in some out-of-the-way place completely unconscious, smelling of drink and vomit. Another was known to be unnecessarily brutal, especially to his mate and her children, and the Zelandania had talked of ways to intercede, waiting only for his mate to ask for help. Then, almost hidden in the shadows, she caught sight of Brukeval, sitting somewhat off by himself with his back to a tall, roughly pointed stump, taking a drink from one of the bags. His temper still bothered her, but he was a cousin of Jondalar's and had always been kind to her. She hated to see him with such an unsavory lot. She was about to turn away when she heard Wolf growl low in his throat. A voice spoke up loudly behind her back.
"Well, look what we have here, the animal lover, and a couple of animals."
She spun around in surprise. "A couple of animals," she thought, "but I only have Wolf." It took her a moment before she realized that he had called Etchazar an animal. She felt her anger rise.
"The only animal I see here is a wolf. Or were you thinking of yourself?"
Ayla countered. There were a few guffaws from some who had heard the remarks, and she saw the man frown.
"I wasn't saying I was an animal," he said.
"That's good. I wouldn't put yourself in the same category as Wolf. You don't measure up," she said.
Some of the other men pulled the brush aside to see what was going on. They saw Ayla holding her daughter on one hip, her leg in front of the wolf to restrain him, and Etchazar holding a torch.
"She sneaked up and was watching us," the man said defensively.
"I was walking along a main path and stopped to see who was making all the noise," Ayla said.
"Who is she, and why does she talk so funny?" asked a young man Ayla didn't know.
Then he added with surprise,
"That's a wolf."
Ayla had all but forgotten about her accent, and so had most of the people who knew her, but occasionally a stranger brought it to her attention. From the pattern on the man's shirt and the design of the necklace he wore, she guessed he was from a cave that lived on another river to the north, a group that did not regularly attend their summer meeting. He must have arrived only recently.
"She's Ayla of the Ninth Cave, the one Jondalar brought back with him,"
Madraman said.
"And she's a Zelandani who can control animals," another man said.
Ayla thought he was from their neighbor, the 14th Cave.
"She's not Zelandani," Madraman said with an air of condescension. "She's an acolyte, still in training."
He had obviously not yet seen her new tattoo, Ayla thought.
"But when she came, she could already control that wolf and a couple of horses," the man from the 14th Cave said. "I told you she was an animal lover," the first man said with a sneer, looking pointedly at Etchazar.
Etchazar glared back and moved towards Ayla protectively. This was a large group of men, and they had been drinking Larimar's brew. It had been known to bring out the worst in people.
"You mean like those horses from that cave camped upstream?" the stranger said. "That's the first place I was taken when I got here. She's the one who controls them. I thought it was that man and the girl."
"Gray is my horse," John Ayla spoke up.
"They're all the same, Harth,"
Brukeval said, strolling into the firelight. Ayla glanced from Brukeval to Etchazar and saw their similarity immediately. Brukeval was clearly a modified version of Etchazar, though neither of them was fully clan.
"I think you should let Ayla get on her way," Brukeval continued, "and I think it might be smart to have our parties a little farther off the main path in the future."
"Yes, I think that is a good idea," said another voice that had suddenly appeared.
Joharan, accompanied by some other men, stepped into the light of the torch held by Etchazar. Several of them had unlit torches, which they immediately lit from Etchazar's, showing how many there were.
"We heard you and came to see what was going on. There are plenty of places to have drinking parties, Larimar. I don't think you men need to be bothering people who are walking along main paths between camps. Perhaps you should move your party now. We don't need children stumbling over you in the morning.
He can't tell us where to go,
a slurred voice called out.
That's right. He can't tell us where to go, said the first man who had seen Ayla. It's all right, Larimar said, picking up several of the small drinking bags that had not been unstoppered and putting them in a back frame. I'd rather find a place where we won't be bothered.
Bruchaval began to help him. He glanced up at Ayla and caught her eye. She smiled at him with gratitude for taking her part and suggesting they move. He smiled back with a lingering expression that puzzled her, then frowned and looked away. She put John Ayla down and knelt to restrain Wolf while the men moved off.
I was going to walk over to the Lanzadanyi camp to talk to Dalinar anyway, Etchazar,
Joharan said.
Why don't you walk back with me? Ayla can go on with Soliban and the others.
Ayla wondered what was so important that Joharan had to talk to Dalinar about that it couldn't wait until morning. Neither one was going anywhere in the dark. Then she noticed a few of the men who had been sitting around the fireplace move out from behind a bush and head in the direction the others had taken, their heads turning to watch Etchazar, Joharan, and a couple of others go. She frowned with concern. Something did not feel right.
I have never seen such goings-on with the Zelindania, Joharan commented. Have you heard anything about the special ceremony everyone says they're planning? Ayla has her mark, but they haven't announced her yet. They usually do it right away. Has she said anything to you? She's been so busy with the Zelindania, I haven't seen much of her,
Jandalar said, which was not entirely true. He had not seen much of her, but not because she was so busy. He was the one who had been staying away, and his brother knew it.
Well, it looks like they must be planning something very big. Zelindani spent a long time talking with Proliva, and she told me the Zelindania want a huge, elaborate feast. They are even talking to Larimar about supplying his brew for the festival. We're getting together a hunting party. Probably be gone a day or two. Do you want to join us?
Joharan asked.
Yes,
Jandalar answered, almost too quickly, causing his brother to give him a questioning look.
I'd be glad to.
If he'd been thinking straight, Jandalar might have recalled that Ayla had said something to him when he first saw her, but he hadn't been able to think of anything but Ayla finding him with Morona since the incident. He just couldn't bring himself to simply crawl into the sleeping furs beside her under the circumstances. He didn't even know if she would let him. He was certain he had lost her, but was afraid to find out for sure. He thought he had managed to find a plausible excuse for not returning to their camp another night when Proliva asked him about it. He had actually slept near the horse enclosure using horse blankets and the ground covering he and Morona had used at the swimming place for bedding to keep warm. But he didn't think he could continue staying away without arousing curiosity from the whole camp. Being away on a hunting trip would solve the problem for the next day or two. He didn't even want to think beyond that. Though Ayla was trying to behave as if nothing was wrong, and Jandalar thought his avoidance of her went unnoticed, in fact, the whole camp was aware by now that something was wrong between the couple, and many guessed what it was. His clandestine trysts with Morona were not nearly so secret as he had thought. To most people, he was just being appropriately discreet, and they ignored the affair. But the news that the formerly doting couple had not even shared the same bed since Ayla arrived, even though Morona had moved to a different camp, had spread quickly. It was the kind of gossip people loved to speculate about. The fact that Ayla had been marked as a Zelindani without being immediately announced,
and that plans for a major ceremony were underway, only added to the delicious innuendos. People were guessing that the event had something to do with the newest Zelandani, but no one seemed to know.